Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Jim Fander, and I'm a professor of law and sometime guest host on the program, sitting in today for Celeste Quinn. I'm pleased to introduce our guest, William Davey, the Edwin Adams Professor of Law at the University of Illinois College of Law. Professor Davey specializes in international trade and European Union law and has leading books in both fields. He's published dozens of articles on the subject and has served from 1995 to 1999 as the legal director of the World Trade Organization in Geneva. Since he returned to the faculty here in 1999, he's been in great demand at academic meetings around the world as an authority on dispute resolution, dumping, and other intricacies of international trade law. Professor Davey, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We have a lot of things to talk about this afternoon, what with the recent breakdown of world trade talks in Cancun, but I wanted to take a moment to remind listeners that they're invited to join the discussion. The phone numbers here are 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. In each case, the last four digits, our numbers correspond to the call letters of the station, WILL. Well, let's start with a short introduction to the World Trade Organization. I gather it's the successor to the old General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, popularly known as GATT. At one time, these were initials known only to trade insiders, and discussions of world trade issues were likely to cause the public's eyes to glaze over. But today, world trade has entered the mainstream of American life. Ministerial meetings invariably attract great media attention and a spate of worldwide protests. It would help, Bill, if you could introduce the WTO and in particular help us to see what role the United States played in its creation and what we hope to gain from the organization.
Well, the WTO came into existence January 1st, 1995. As you say, it incorporated GATT, which had been around for almost 50 years at that point. At the moment, the WTO has 148 members and includes virtually all major trading nations with the exception of Russia and Saudi Arabia, both of which are now negotiating their accession to the WTO. The main functions of the WTO are listed in the agreement that establishes it, and there are five. The first function is simply to administer the complex set of agreements that the various countries have entered into as part of the WTO. That includes GATT, but also a number of sometimes referred to as side agreements to GATT dealing with trade in goods. There's also an agreement known as GATS, the General Agreement on Trade in Services, and one on trade-related aspects of intellectual property. Essentially, the organization itself is rather small as international organizations go. The staff is only 500 or 600 people based in Geneva, Switzerland. Their main function is to serve the numerous committees of the members, the countries that are parties to the agreement, and their meetings, which they have constantly in Geneva. That's the main function, is to administer the trade agreements. The second function is to conduct negotiations, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later, I think. The meeting in Cancun was one of those negotiations. The third function is dispute settlement. When you have a complex set of agreements, there are going to be disputes between members of the WTO over what they mean, and the dispute settlement system serves as a way to clarify the meaning of the agreements and ultimately ensure that the agreements are enforced. It takes many years to negotiate these agreements. It would make little sense if you spend all that time not to have some sort of enforcement mechanism, and the dispute settlement function provides that. The other two functions are not quite so important. One is called the trade policy review function. Essentially, it's a mechanism by which the organization, through its membership, reviews the trade policies of each member on a regular basis and criticizes those aspects of the trade policies that are perhaps not completely in accord with agreements or need, in the view of the membership, some improvement. And finally, the WTO is supposed to improve coherence in international economic policymaking by coordinating with the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. As a practical matter, not a whole lot has been done with respect to coherence. But those are the main functions. And I suppose the other thing worth knowing about the WTO is what are kind of the general principles that underlie those agreements that I've mentioned. And looking through the various agreements, you can see four principles, I think. One is trade liberalization. The WTO doesn't provide for free trade. It provides a forum for negotiating freer trade. Tariffs, for example, have been a subject of negotiation for over 50 years now, and they have been significantly reduced, although they still exist. Back in the 40s, when GATT first came into existence, average tariffs in the industrialized world were on the order of 40%. They're now down around 4%, so a fairly significant reduction. Now, trade liberalization is not complete. It's not without qualification. For example, in the event that liberalization or freer trade leads to serious injury of a domestic industry, there's an exception to the rules that allows you to, at least on a temporary basis, up to 8 years, impose restrictions on trade. An example of that that's been in the news recently are the safeguard measures, protective measures, that the United States has applied to help the steel industry. President Bush is currently reviewing whether or not to extend those. They're somewhat controversial. A number of members have claimed that they don't meet the criteria that the WTO establishes, and they've actually won a case in dispute settlement on that. But the U.S. at this point has not yet implemented that decision. So that's one principle, trade liberalization. A second very basic principle is non-discrimination. Essentially, the WTO provides that if you give some favors to one country, you should give those same favors in the trade arena to other countries. It's known as the most favored nation principle, and it's a very basic principle in the WTO. A second non-discrimination principle is what is known as the national treatment principle. And this basically says that once foreign goods are in your country, you won't discriminate against them vis-a-vis domestic goods. You can impose tariffs, quite high tariffs, to keep them out, but once they're in, you'll treat them the same as domestic goods. Now, there are exceptions to those rules, of course, as well. For example, the MFN obligation, the obligation not to discriminate amongst countries, there's an exception for favorable provisions for developing countries, so you can discriminate in favor of developing countries. And you can also discriminate by forming free trade agreements, free trade areas or customs unions, where the members of those units can discriminate in favor of each other's trade if they meet certain WTO rules. That's the second principle, non-discrimination. The third general principle is fair trade. There are a number of rules that allow countries to restrict trade if the trade is viewed as unfair. An example would be dumping. That's when one country exports to another at either a price below the cost of production or a price below the price charged normally in the country of export. So that's viewed as dumping your products on the world market. If that causes injury to a domestic industry, you can impose duties to offset the level of dumping. There's a similar sort of rule that allows you to offset by duties the subsidies that lead to greater exports and harm your domestic industry. And finally, the fourth principle is transparency. There are a lot of rules in the WTO that essentially require you to publicize the various laws that may affect trade. And these, of course, go far beyond duties. There are all sorts of restrictions when goods come into a country. They have to meet various safety standards and so on. And this sort of thing is required to be published so that traders can find out what the rules are and then decide whether or not trade is worthwhile. Now, you asked about what was the specific role of the United States in establishing the WTO. Well, the WTO was more a Canadian-European initiative. The United States was not particularly interested. It wasn't necessarily opposed, but was not all that supportive. But at the end of the Uruguay round negotiations, those negotiations lasted from 1986 to 1993, the U.S. finally agreed that it would go along with the establishment of a new organization. The only condition that the U.S. had at the very end was that Senator Moynihan insisted that the name be the World Trade Organization instead of the then-planned Multilateral Trade Organization. And in fact, at the last meeting, right before the gavel came down on the agreements, the document in front of all of the delegates said Multilateral Trade Organization, with one sheet of paper on top that said, wherever it says MTO, read WTO, wherever it says World Trade Organization, or Multilateral Trade Organization, read World Trade Organization. For whatever reason, Senator Moynihan wanted World Trade Organization, and he got his way.
Didn't he also object to permanent or most favored nation status as well and offer a different definition of that?
Right. There are some who think when they hear about most favored nation treatment, think, well, this is some special treatment you give your particular friends. In the case of the United States at the moment, the only countries that don't get at least most favored nation treatment are North Korea, Cuba, and Laos. And so he wanted to change the title to normal trade relations, so to suggest that there was really no special favor being done the country that was given MFN treatment. Now, what the U.S. hopes to get out of the WTO is a more liberal trading environment. The belief in the United States since the Second World War is that more open trading system will benefit the United States economically in the long run. And so U.S. policy since basically the Roosevelt-Truman days has been in favor of a more open multilateral trading system. Now, the interest of the United States waxes and wanes over the years as to exactly how hard it's pushing for more trade liberalization. But by and large, over time, the U.S. has pushed for this because it thinks it's economically beneficial overall for the United States.
I see. And you mentioned that one of the functions of the WTO is to provide a framework for negotiations. And could you give us a little bit of background on how these negotiations unfold? How is it that people decide what subjects will come up? I know at the recent Cancun round of negotiations that ended in a much ballyhooed walkout by the developing countries, the focus was going to be on agriculture. But is there any magic to the selection of agriculture as the subject of the moment? How do those ministerial rounds get set up and unfold?
Well, essentially, GATT, or now the WTO, has negotiated on a fairly regular basis every decade or so. There seems to be a new round of negotiations, and they usually take a very long time. And over time, they have gradually covered more and more issues. Agriculture is almost always an issue because the amount of trade liberalization in agriculture is relatively low compared to industrialized products. So agriculture is almost always a controversial issue. As to what else gets negotiated, part of it is simply based on what the WTO agreements cover. To the extent there's an agreement, say, covering trade and services, or an agreement that focuses on binding tariff levels, tariffs and services these days are likely always to be in the mix of negotiations. Now, the other issues that may be negotiated are a subject of negotiation in themselves. So far, what they now call the Doha Round or the Doha Development Agenda, the current round of negotiations in the WTO, this was attempted to be launched at the Seattle ministerial meeting. By ministerial meeting, I mean a high-level meeting where the participants are cabinet-level officials. In the United States, you'd have the Secretary of Agriculture and the United States Trade Representative attending such a meeting. Well, at Seattle, they were unable to launch the negotiations, in part because of controversy over what the subject should be. 2 years later, 2001, in Doha, they were able to launch the negotiations, although there was still considerable controversy over how broad the negotiations should be. One difference between Seattle and Doha was the United States and the EC, particularly France, but the EC generally, gave up an attempt to have any trade and labor issues in the negotiations. But the EC, which has been pushing for a very broad agenda for the negotiations, insisted at Doha that there be four new issues negotiated in the Doha round. The developing countries weren't willing to start the negotiations on these four new areas at Doha, but agreed that they would negotiate on them at Cancun if modalities could be agreed upon. Now, the four issues are trade and competition or antitrust law, trade and investment, transparency, openness in government procurement, and something called trade facilitation, which is simply to simplify the matter, the way in which trade is conducted to make goods pass through borders in less complicated way. Now, at Cancun, in fact, although agriculture was a serious problem, the talks actually collapsed over the issue of whether or not to proceed with the new these four new issues. By the end of the Cancun ministerial, the EC had given up on competition, investment, and was indicating it would probably give up on transparency and government procurement, but was still trying to get negotiations on trade facilitation. But at that point, some of the countries that the EC had convinced that competition and investment were important, Japan and Korea, didn't want to give up those issues. And developing countries, in part because of difficulties in the agricultural negotiations, but in part their general annoyance at the way things were unfolding, basically refused to go along with any negotiations on any of those new issues. And so what gets negotiated is a subject of negotiation, and it often takes years to establish an agenda, even after the negotiations start, because everything is always subject to renegotiation. The expression is nothing is agreed until everything is agreed, and someone is always trying to raise an issue that everyone else thought had been decided and see if they can't make some more for their own position on it.
So we start off with 148 countries represented in Cancun, all negotiating on these four issues that you've identified, as well as on agricultural issues, trying to find some consensus. I guess it's not surprising then to learn that the Uruguay round spread out over a seven-year period as multilateral talks continued.
Yes, and one thing that's different about the WTO, which is actually quite important, is that its decisions are taken on a consensus basis. This is unlike other international organizations. The IMF, the World Bank, there is weighted voting based on your contributions to the organization. That means the United States and a few European countries control those organizations completely. In the UN, you have one country, one vote on issues. As a result, the developing world can often get its way in negotiations in the UN. At the WTO, though, the rule is consensus. And so until everyone is willing to go ahead, nothing happens. Now, obviously, larger countries, because of their political power in the world, have more influence in the long run than a small island state. But the small island state can hold up things for some period of time if it's dissatisfied with what's going on. So the process of trying to bring everyone together is very difficult. You have to start with a few countries often, then gradually expand the number that are willing to take some sort of step. You have to make sure that pretty early on you have everybody in your circle or in your group that has a serious interest in the issue. Otherwise, when they find out later that they weren't included at the beginning, they'll be angry and may not agree even if they otherwise would have agreed. And gradually you try and expand that until nobody is opposed. Or if at the best you can do, there are only one or two opposed. Often countries who are isolated like that will eventually give in if there is what they call an emerging consensus or a critical mass of countries that's ready to go forward. But if someone feels very strongly, they can delay things for a long time. And of course, where you have organized groups, in the agricultural negotiations, for example, at Cancun, there was a group of 22 developing countries. Well, you have a group that large. If they're not willing to go forward, obviously you're going to have a problem reaching agreement.
It seems like in order to put a consensus like that together, you have to find a series of issues that will appeal to all sides of the negotiating process. So you can understand then why, for example, the EC or the European Community might have put together a list of things that it was interested in with the understanding that the developing countries would be pushing for some help in the agricultural area. So the EC was proposing to gain a little bit of access to those markets for its manufactured goods in exchange for some liberalization in the agricultural area. It's interesting that the portrait of the breakdown of those talks focused not on the other issues that the EC had placed on the table, but for the most part on the unwillingness of the developed world, I guess, to meet the developing countries halfway on agriculture.
Yeah, I think that although technically the breakdown came over what they call the Singapore issues, these four issues that were first discussed at a meeting in Singapore, some believe that perhaps Mexico, which was chairing the meeting, did that as a favor to the United States, since it would look like perhaps the EC issues were the real problem. But nonetheless, probably the most controversial issue at the talks was agriculture. And progress in a number of other areas is often said to be dependent on agriculture. No one wants to agree until they know what's going to happen in agriculture. And you're right that the EC had raised these new issues in part, so it would be able to gain something in return for its concessions that it assumed it would ultimately have to make in agriculture. Now, agriculture in the WTO is very controversial issue. GATT applied to agriculture, but as a practical matter, because of waivers that benefited the United States and various actions that the EC had taken when it was formed in the 1950s, most people basically viewed agriculture as outside the scope of GATT, that GATT did not effectively control it. For the first time in trade negotiations, the Uruguay round made serious stabs at having some real control and liberalization in the agricultural area. Basically, it did that through three different areas. The first area was market access. Prior to the Uruguay round, countries had various and sundry mechanisms, quotas, or flexible tariffs that changed every day to make sure it was not profitable to import agricultural products. They had various mechanisms to really restrict market access. In the Uruguay round, it was agreed to convert all of those mechanisms into tariffs. The problem was some of those tariffs are very high now, on the order of even 600%, which obviously means not very much trade would occur. Now, in order to ensure that there would be at least a minimum level of trade, it was agreed that from 3 to 5% of a country's domestic market would be open at a lower tariff rate to trade. And in the negotiations at Doha, and now again at Cancun, in the agricultural area, one issue is, well, how much should this market access amount be expanded? Now, the initial attempt in the agricultural negotiations by a man named Stuart Harbinson, who is the special assistant to the director general of the WTO and was the person responsible for brokering the Doha compromise that led to these negotiations. He's formerly the representative of Hong Kong to the WTO. He had come up with rather specific proposals to lower tariffs significantly, at least the high tariffs, and to expand the market access quotas from 5% to roughly 10% over a 5-year period. this was quite would require a lot of change on the part of some countries. And neither the U.S. nor the EC, which came up with their own proposal, nor Brazilian group, the G22 group, had went as far as he would probably go. And part of the problem here is there are some countries, Japan, Norway, Iceland, Korea, who don't want to expand access to agricultural markets at all. So this is a very controversial issue. And by and large, developing countries who wouldn't be expected to expand as much as the U.S. or EC in any ultimate deal also often don't want to expand access particularly. So market access in agriculture was one major problem. Another one is export subsidies. These are relatively controversial. They're mainly used by the European communities, basically because of the high prices that result from the EC's agricultural policy in Europe. It would not be possible to export certain commodities without some sort of subsidy program. And the EC spends some billions of dollars a year on these subsidies. The U.S. has from time to time, although at the moment it's not doing much in the way of export subsidy, I don't believe. The Harbinson proposal was to eliminate export subsidies in the course of 9 or 10 years or so. The USEC proposal was only that, well, maybe we should just kind of reduce them, phase them out over some indeterminate length of period. The developing countries who are adversely affected by these export subsidies and that their exports are displaced wanted a phase out and not just a reduction over some shorter period of time. The third area in agriculture, which is controversial, is domestic subsidies. The Harbinson proposal proposed significant reductions, but by and large, the U.S. proposal, the USEC proposal, didn't go as far. But the developing countries wanted much more in the way of limits on domestic subsidies. The domestic subsidy situation under WTO rules is quite complicated. They have various colored boxes or colored subsidies. If you have green subsidies, they're okay, and you can have unlimited amounts of money devoted to green subsidies. Now, you might think that green subsidies had something to do with environmental correctness, but that's not the case. They could, but not necessarily. A green subsidy is one that's not tied to production, and it's like a traffic light. It's okay to give those sorts of subsidies, essentially because they're thought to be not so market distorting. Now, of course, in fact, if you give a lot of subsidies that way, there will be distortions on the market. Even if you're not, for example, specifically subsidizing exports, this will make exports more easily made because of these subsidies. Well, the U.S. and the EC don't particularly want to cut green subsidies. The developing world would like to see them reduced. You also have amber subsidies, yellow light subsidies. These are not prohibited, but the agreement in the Uruguay round was starting on a base year, you would reduce those somewhat. Now, as negotiators often do, they picked a particularly high base year, so the reductions really weren't all that significant in the end. But the proposal, again, is in the current negotiations that we have to reduce these by some degree. There are also blue box subsidies. These are subsidies that are production related, but they're allowed within limits as they also have a production reduction aspect to them. The developing countries would like to eliminate those. The U.S. and the EC would like to continue to have some options. This all became quite controversial right before the round, with a number of articles in newspapers and so on about the effect of U.S. domestic cotton subsidies on some African countries that otherwise, if the U.S. industry wasn't so heavily subsidized, could export cotton. That made the agricultural negotiations much more of a developing split and caused, to some degree, the U.S. and the EC to try and find common ground.
In case you've just tuned in and you're trying to figure out how blue box subsidies, green subsidies, and amber subsidies fit into the topic at hand, our guest today is Professor William Davey from the University of Illinois College of Law, and we're talking about the World Trade Organization and its recent Cancun round of ministerial negotiations. My name is Jim Vander, and I wanted to offer those phone numbers to you again. The local number is 333-9455, and the 800 number, good wherever you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Bill, one of the questions that countries have to think about when they're trying to decide whether to enter into trade agreements, either multilateral ones or bilateral ones, is how those agreements will be enforced in case they run afoul of them. Could you sketch for us quickly the dispute resolution process that is in place under the WTO and what impact that has on willingness to agree?
Sure. The WTO has a fairly significant and dispute settlement system by international standards. Essentially, if you have a dispute with another country, you start by consulting with them. The hope is that you will resolve your dispute. If you don't, you go through an arbitral process. And it's possible at the end of that to appeal the result. But if ultimately you lose, you're expected to bring your measure that was challenged into conformity with your WTO obligations. If you don't do that, there is the potential in the long run for retaliatory trade sanctions to be applied against you. This system is quite remarkable for international purposes. Most international systems are not so automatic or don't lead to something like trade sanctions.
We have a caller on line one from Urbana. Are you there?
Yes.
Join us, please.
I'm curious how the World Trade Organization can be legally ended, or how can the United States legally pull out?
Okay, that's a good question, Bill. Many people are worried about the loss of sovereignty entailed by the U.S. entry into the World Trade Organization, and one question is how we could get out if we wanted to.
And I'm going to hang up and listen.
Okay, very well.
Most trade agreements in the WTO and GATT are examples of that, can be terminated. In the case of the WTO, it requires six months' notice. So the U.S. could decide to leave the WTO if it wished. There was, in fact, a mechanism built into the law by which Congress approved the WTO that required consideration to be given to leaving the WTO after about 5 years. And a vote was held in the House on that. It was overwhelmingly rejected, but there was a vote a few years ago in the House of Representatives.
And would it take legislative action, or would presidential action be enough under the current state of our
Well, I'm not completely certain in my own mind how free President Bush is to withdraw the United States from international obligations. As you know, he sometimes does that. I think it's fair to say that it's unlikely that an administration would do this without congressional approval. An awful lot of U.S. law is now more or less based on WTO rules. And if you were going to leave the WTO, you might well want to change those rules as well. And that would have to be done legislatively.
I see. We also have a caller on line two from Champaign County. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. When you were talking about dispute resolution, I thought you had mentioned that out of, I think, the 13 major cases that have gone to WTO, I think all but one were completely went against the U.S. and the many House Republicans are very concerned and maybe regret that five-year revisiting law. They may regret their vote against it because a lot of them are agitating. And they had a study that was done that was showing that that was probably going to keep going that way, too, because the U.S. isn't really a paragon of free trade for itself. It's a do-as-we-say, not-as-we-do kind of country in a lot of ways, and trade is one of those. I would suggest that people go to globalexchange.org and look at top reasons for pulling out of the WTO. And also note that Kucinich, at one of the debates, said the first thing he would do as president, not that I'm holding my breath that he's going to win, but he is actually campaigning and getting a lot of support from a lot of different sectors of the society and economy for getting out of this supranational organization that mainly is beholden to corporate demands and is not transparent. It calls for transparency amongst the governments and corporations, but it itself is not very transparent when it comes to how it makes its decisions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I hope you have somebody on from that sector, Global Exchange. Kevin Danaher is quite well-spoken, and it'd be great to hear him as well as someone who is right out of the organization. And I'll hang on if you want a colloquy, but...
As you wish. Bill, do the decisions tend to go against the U.S.? Is that your sense?
Actually, I think the U.S. is kind of 50-50, maybe a little better on decisions. Most of the decisions that the U.S. has lost involve trade remedy rules. These are the U.S. anti-dumping rules, the U.S. Safeguard rules, which allow for protection of an industry if it's been seriously injured by imports. On the positive side, the U.S. has won a number of cases against the EC, and I think it's a little hard to say that we usually lose. If you look at the trade remedy area, though, you're right. We usually do lose in the trade remedy area. And there was a GAO report that came out, I don't know, maybe a month and a half ago, that studied all of the trade remedy cases. Its conclusion was that the U.S. wasn't being treated differently than other countries. But there's no doubt that these laws are – the U.S. has been found to violate WTO rules with respect to these laws. And because Congress actually, these are corporate interests that are being hurt, and Congress is very concerned about, you know, the steel industry and so on. They're the ones that are complaining to Congress about these particular defeats for the United States. As to transparency generally, all of the dispute settlement reports are published on the web the day they're circulated to members. And to the extent there were anything, for example, would come out of the current round of negotiations, that always has to be approved by legislatures. The WTO has been approved essentially by all 148 parliaments or congressional agencies in its member countries. So to say it's not transparent, a little overstating it, although I'll admit you can't go to the meetings and watch.
We have a caller on line 3 in Urbana. Hello?
Yeah, I have a reading suggestion to Public Citizen has a new book by the New Press called Whose Trade Organization? The Comprehensive Guide to the WTO. But I understand your guest is a law expert, correct?
That is correct. Professor right. of law at the university here.
Yeah, there's a lot that could be said in terms of economics. Like, for example, which your guest probably wouldn't be able to address, but the AFL-CIO calculates that our trade deficit, which is at an all-time record, represents a drag of 4.2% on U.S. economic growth. The World Bank says that the number of people in the world living under a dollar a day, their idea of extreme poverty has risen since the WTO went into effect. We've lost at least 500,000 jobs since NAFTA, for example, went into effect. But let me try to talk about legal issues. I was just curious about two things, really. One is I didn't understand what might be the going on here. There was a article in the Tribune recently that said that this was June 15th, said the WTO arbitrator gave the United States until December 27th to repeal a law giving American companies the fines collected from foreign firms they accused of unfair pricing. And that just didn't make any sense to me. Can you explain why the WTO would care what we did with money we collected from, you know, these kind of conflicts? Or
thank you. So two questions. Can we address the economics of world trade? Is it net a good thing or a bad thing? Is there a giant sucking sound that that results in loss of jobs, as Ross Perot predicted when he thought about NAFTA? And secondly, what about the particulars of the case that was identified?
Okay, on the general question of economics, I do know a little bit. I brought a couple of pages of statistics with me. In terms of poverty, actually, the number of percentage of people living below a dollar a day between 1990 and 2000 went down, mainly because of China. It stayed the same or gone up a bit in Africa, but for East Asia, there's actually been a significant reduction in poverty. NAFTA job losses are quite controversial. The government would claim there are 900,000 positive jobs compared to the 500,000 you mentioned that are the Labor Department's estimate of people directly affected. As to the final question, it involves something called the Byrd Amendment. And essentially the issue is the WTO has specific rules on when you are how you handle dumping. And the issue in the case is whether or not the Byrd Amendment goes beyond what is permitted. And both the initial arbitral panel and the appellate group decided that it does. That's why the U.S. is expected to change. It was a close question. I'm not sure I would have come out the same way. But it's because the U.S. agreed to a certain way to handle dumping issues.
We're running out of time, but I'd like to get a couple more callers on if we can. We have a caller on line 4 from Belgium. Are you there? We have a caller on line 1 then.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hello. Thank you.
Hello?
Yes, please.
Yes. I understand that the European Union is developing something called the Food Supplement Directive. And some people here feel that this is going to result in draconian restrictions on the availability of food supplements in the United States. If this is something that you know about, could you explain what's going on and how a decision in the European Union could have that kind of result for Americans?
I've only read in the paper some reference to the fact that the EC was planning to control supplements more than we do. I don't see how that would affect their availability in the United States unless, at the moment, the only source is in Europe. Otherwise, I would expect availability to remain the same in the United States.
I see. All right. Well, thank you.
We have a caller on line 2 from Champaign. No? That caller has dropped off. Bill, any final thoughts about where we go from here?
Well, I guess that the end of Doha, Cancun meeting, everyone basically said, well, the rest of you are just not negotiating reasonably, so we're going to go off and negotiate bilaterally with all our various and sundry true friends. That was said by the EC, the U.S., Brazil, and so forth. So at the moment, probably nothing much is going to happen in the multilateral negotiations. And what you'll probably see is much more emphasis on regional trading arrangements. The U.S. at the moment is negotiating free trade agreements with Australia, Morocco, South African Customs Union, and 5 Central American countries. It's also talking about having more negotiations on these free trade areas. So that's probably what we're going to see. Although in the end, the WTO probably has to exist simply as a place where the major trading nations can resolve disputes and where the major issues such as agriculture, which are typically just forgotten about in these bilateral arrangements because it's too difficult to solve, you need a place to resolve those issues. So the future for the WTO doesn't look all that rosy perhaps at the moment, but because there has to be something like it, one can expect, I think, that it will continue to exist.
I want to thank our guest today, Professor Bill Davey from the University of Illinois, and thank all the callers who joined our conversation. My name is Jim Fander, and now we head out to the Farm Progress Show.